This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me in the studio is Chaim Goodman-Strauss.
Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Chaim. Chaim is a math professor at the University of Arkansas. And with us on the phone,
Clifford Pickover. Hi, Cliff. How are you doing?
Hi, good to be here.
And you're here to talk about your new The Math Book.
Yes, thanks. Very good.
Beautiful book.
Thanks. Yeah, it's my first book that has basically all color. It's the history of math from Stone Age till today. And I hope the color photos and all the nice illustrations will attract a broad audience.
Oh, it's fantastic. And it's already number 80th on Amazon, did you say?
Yeah, it's doing pretty well
so
far. That's
amazing. Yeah, for a math book, that's got to be close to a record.
It is set up in a chronological manner. It is actually kind of the biography of mathematics.
Yeah, I tried to cover a whole range of topics from computing devices, and we actually start out pre-human with animals and work all the way up till today with just one page for each entry. So one of the challenges was to sort of do a high-level summary for a pretty broad audience so they can get the essence of each milestone.
Yeah, that's great. Each page is, each topic's a couple of paragraphs, three paragraphs, something like that.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful images that accompany each. And when you say you start at the beginning, you just about do. Ant odometers in 150 million BC?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite entries. It starts the book pre-human, and it has to do with some very unusual research. We have these Saharan desert ants that live in the deserts of Tunisia, and researchers have found that they actually seem to have a counter or computer in the brain. And the research is very strange. It's hard to believe people actually do this, but they were out on the deserts, and these ants start with a hole, let's say the size of a millimeter. They can go out hundreds of feet and somehow return. And while out far from the hole, the researchers actually glued stilts to the legs to make the legs longer. And then as the ants proceeded to come back to the hole in the ground, they overshot the hole. And when they cut the legs, they didn't quite reach the hole. And it led the researchers to believe that the ants are actually counting steps to determine the distance back to the hole. So that's an interesting and primitive example of how counting, or something like counting, may have started.
That's amazing. Do they know anything about the mechanism that might be going on?
Well, they know something about how the ants are operating, where they can judge something about the direction with a reference to light in the sky, but I don't think they know too much about what's happening inside the brain. What's particularly interesting is that these ants don't use scent trails to get back. A lot of the ants we might see around, for instance, in our homes or neighborhoods, they lay down a scent trail, but on the hot deserts where it can reach like 140 degrees Fahrenheit, any type of scent trail disappear pretty quickly, so they're not using that to get around.
I guess you have another insect entry in your book on cicadas.
Yeah, sometimes I must have been in love with insects when I started this. The cicada is also a fascinating example of an insect that seems to have some reference to numbers. These are these creatures that live most of their lives underground, and a particular set of or class of cicadas emerge every 13 or 17 years from the ground. And as you might recognize, 13 and 17 are prime numbers. That is, numbers that can't be divided by one or themselves. And we wonder, why 13? Why 17? And one of the theories is that this may be a way to avoid predators with life cycles that are smaller.
Right.
So, for example, if something, had a life cycle of 2 years, two wouldn't divide into 13, or 3 years, or four, or five. It just wouldn't divide evenly into these prime numbers, and it might be a way for the cicadas to avoid some of these predators.
That's right. So, I guess, but they don't have any examples with 11 or 7 or...
Yeah, it's quite mysterious because we don't have all the answers why these particular prime numbers, precisely what predator is driving this. But there are, not all cicadas are these periodical cicadas, just certain members of a certain genus. But there has been computer research where researchers have model cicadas, sort of synthetic cicadas, I would call them, and introducing predators sometimes does force these into these prime number life cycles. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, that is. I've seen those, you know, just a few times, and it's really quite a mess. Really, they just seem to flood out, don't they?
You know, yeah, in fact, they call that predator satiation, and get like a 1.5 million of these creatures all of a sudden in acres. So the birds or these predator wasps can't possibly get them all. Hey, but they're kind of creepy looking. Have you seen they have these big bulging eyes, and they climb up in the trees and make that racket, that noise, which is used to attract mates.
You know, about 12 years ago around here, we had the 1 year, 13, and 17 year cicadas all come out at the same time.
Oh, boy.
There were researchers from all over the world that came because, it, you know, do the math. It only happens every, you get the idea. It was the first time since the United States had been a country that had happened this far west.
Wow. Have you heard them? They're very noisy, these creatures.
They have three separate kinds of sounds. Depending on what they're, whether they're looking for a mate, whether they're just emerging, or whether they're eating.
And you, hey, would your radio audience, would they like to, or podcast audience, like to hear some? I have a nice tape of
please,
some.
Please, yeah.
This will be a mysterious. Let's see. Let's get them. Here they are.
I want to ask you, because this book is arranged chronologically, how did you decide how many math events or math entries would be included in the book, and were there some that you would have to eliminate?
Yeah, I tried to capture a whole range of milestones, from very important, very famous conjectures and problems, but also I wanted to get some, you know, nice quirky things. Puzzles, a few things I almost touched on games, and things that could be illustrated. But the idea was to give this taste for mathematics using, you know, a few formulas, but not too much. And I want to stretch the imagination the whole way through it. But of course, some of it is what interests me personally. So I'm sure, you know, you or other mathematicians can go through and say, Cliff, why didn't you include this? Or what about that? But I think, you know, I captured quite a few significant milestones.
Yeah, it's a fantastic collection.
Was there one particular milestone that it was just on the edge, but it didn't make it into the math book?
Well, there are a few. I mean, Rubik's Cube's in there. I really did want to put Rubik's Cube in there. There are some in the history of math, which, you know, I was wondering about. One I think we talked about was the Curta calculator.
Oh, yeah.
That's an interesting entry, and I think it does deserve a place. It was the first commercially successful portable mechanical calculator.
And it was created in a concentration camp, actually.
Yeah, that's the mysterious. There's some interesting mathematician story behind some of these. This one is one that looks sort of like a pepper grinder. You actually grind it to do your computations. But yeah, the story behind that, which compelled me to really put it in the book, is that it was done by a prisoner in a Nazi concentration camp. The Nazis said, you know, work on this, we'll give it as a gift to Hitler. But luckily, the Buchenwald concentration camp was eventually freed, and Kurt Herzstock, he's the guy who was in the camp, who worked on it, actually, after he left the camp in Europe, he was able to start a manufacturing plant, and they sold over 80,000 of the first model. So I guess it has a good story in the end.
Well, it saved his life, didn't it?
It did. They sort of insisted he worked on it, and then he was valuable to them because of that. And it did become commercially available in around 1948. And that's the fascinating story behind that.
One of the last entries from 2007, the headline on the page is Checkers is Solved.
Yeah, that's one of the more recent ones. Checkers, it's been determined, is in a sense just like tic-tac-toe. If you play perfectly, there's a no-win game. So you can imagine sitting behind, let's say there's a computer that can play perfectly. You make one move, and the computer says, ha-ha, game over. Because it's just like tic-tac-toe.
Right.
And to solve this, they use hundreds of computers over many, many years. And I think it's probably the most complex game ever to be solved in this fashion.
Hmm.
Did they save the game tree? I mean, can they actually play perfectly, or they just know that they
Yeah, that's a good question. I know they investigated, they work backwards from all different moves. I presume they have all the information they need solved. You know, solved and stored, I should say.
Let me ask you about the artwork, because every page, when you open the book, on the left is the text of a mathematical milestone. On the right are gorgeous images. How much of a role did you play in coming up with the pictures that are in the book?
Well, in much of my life, I was very interested in scientific visualization. You know, that is using computer graphics to convey information. You know, obviously looking at pages and pages of numbers is not the best way to gain insight. And mathematics, especially, you know, later when computers became available, was shaped to an extreme degree by computers. You probably have some opinions of this yourself, you know, but fractals and chaos theory and all this really got a punch once computers were available to do research. So to get back to your question, some of the computer graphics I worked on, I'm lucky enough to have computer graphics and computer artist colleagues that I could count on for some of the graphics. And some of them are, you know, ancient pictures of the mathematicians themselves. You know, sometimes we talk about the mathematicians, and occasionally I try to give a glimpse for, well, you know, what do these people really look like?
Yeah, that's so great. The human side of the book is terrific.
Who do you, obviously, if the book has made it to 80th on Amazon, it's not just mathematicians that are picking it up.
Well, I'm thinking it could appeal to teachers and students. You know, one of the ideas is to try to stimulate, you know, maybe a new generation of people, just like Martin Gardner stimulated people to get interested in mathematics through recreational mathematics. Here I'm hoping to stimulate a new generation to, you know, say, look, math is not dry. It can be infinitely beautiful. Some artists or people interested in art from mathematics would certainly be curious about the book. And the publisher actually, for some reason, said science fiction people could be interested.
Funny.
And I'm thinking, why science fiction? I'm thinking probably because some of the entries touch on higher dimensions and the fourth dimension and things of that nature, which can appeal to the mystics and science fiction fans.
Was it difficult at all to come up with the title of the book? I mean, was there ever a debate about that?
There was a debate about the subtitle. The title was very simple, The Math Book, and it came because there was actually a best-selling book called The Science Book that predated this, that I was not involved with, but with that same basic format of a full-page color picture facing one page of text. So that was done for science, and the publisher named Sterling came to me and said, Cliff, how would you like to work on The Math Book? And I said, that sounded great.
Now, what about the subtitle?
The subtitle, currently, the final one is From Pythagoras to the 57th Dimension, 250 Milestones in the History of Mathematics. That's what the publisher liked. I wanted something more like From Pythagoras to Rubik's Cube, or Rubik's Cube Robots, to introduce more of the playfulness of mathematics. And I said to the publisher, 57th dimension, that sounds intriguing, but is anyone going to get what that might mean? And I don't know, you know, within the publishing field, it's kind of interesting. The author has so much say, and then the publisher sort of has the final say. But I shouldn't say I'm unhappy. I'm very happy with how it all worked out.
Well, thank you very much, Cliff. It's a beautiful book. Congratulations. And also, our listeners might be interested in your Twitter feed. I've been enjoying following that, so...
Great. And pickover.com will lead them to more of the sample illustrations from the book if they're curious.
So, Clifford, thank you very much. It's a wonderful book.
Thanks very much. It was great talking to you.
See you later.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.